Thank you, Reverend Hall. To address the topic of how the Constitution establishes religion, we have Graham Walker, who is Associate Professor of Politics at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., and a visiting scholar in religion and philosophy at the American Enterprise Institute, also in that noble city. His scholarly interests include classical philosophy, constitutional issues including religion in law and comparative law, and the American founding, as well as education. He has written for both popular and scholarly journals and magazines, is the author of two books, Moral Foundations of Constitutional Thought and the Ethics of F.A. Hayek. He is currently on the Board of Trustees of Houghton College and an active layman in the Wesleyan Church. He holds several degrees, including an advanced degree from the Graduate Institute of International Studies in Geneva, Switzerland, and a PhD from the University of Notre Dame. He has also served on political staffs, including that of Senator Hayakawa in California and Congressman Stockman here in Michigan.
I always have to move them up just a little bit when I speak. I notice it's very echoey in here, so I will do my best to try to speak distinctly and slowly enough, in spite of my tendency to speed up. My title is How the Constitution Establishes Religion, although if I were to give you a full title, it would also have a subtitle. It would read like this: How the Constitution Establishes Religion and Why We Should Be Glad It Does. And that's because, really, in this brief presentation, I have two points that I want to make. One is a factual argument, and the other is a normative argument. Or to put it differently, I'm going to try to demonstrate to you what the Constitution's rule about religion is. And after I persuade you of that, if I succeed, I will then proceed to argue why that constitutional rule is a good thing. Because after all, it turns out to be quite possible to recognize that the Constitution requires a certain thing and to be quite displeased about it, as you have noticed this week. However, I'm going to argue that what the Constitution requires is also wise and good. So first the factual argument and then the normative argument. With regard to the fact of the matter, where the Constitution touches on religion, I argue, its provisions protect the establishment of religion at subfederal levels of public authority. That's the simple proposition that I want to make at that point. In a way, therefore, the Constitution's treatment of religion is a feature or a subset of the Constitution's federalism. Now, federalism is increasingly opaque to Americans and perhaps increasingly unpopular. I might add that ignorance of or dissatisfaction with America's constitutional federalism lies at the root of this week's dissatisfaction with the Electoral College. Parenthetically, if I might be allowed a slight digression on that point, many people seem unaware that the Electoral College itself is a secondary expression of a feature of the Constitution which is unamendable. You may not realize that the text of the Constitution says that there is one feature of the Constitution which is not subject to amendment, even by the amending procedures laid out in the text. Now, most people are unaware of that. I'll tell you what it is. It's in Article 5, the last sentence, which says that even if you amend the Constitution using all the appropriate procedures, the Constitution may not be amended in such a way as to deprive any state of its equal suffrage in the Senate. And of course, the reason that the Electoral College vote can be different from the popular vote is that Electoral College votes are allocated not only according to population, but also without reference to population in part. That is, each state gets two electoral votes, no matter how tiny their population. And that feature of the Electoral College is amendable, to be sure, but it is an expression of the one feature and the only feature of the American Constitution which is unamendable. And therefore, presumably, that feature of the Constitution most earnestly desired to be protected by our founders. So if anyone speaks to you about the Electoral College, please refer them to Article 5, the last sentence. Federalism, therefore, is fundamental to the American Constitution. This crowd is more apt to hear that than most. But my point now, of course, is that the constitutional rule for religion is a feature of federalism. The Constitution, in summary, protects not only the private promotion of religion by private persons in private, and the Constitution not only protects the promotion of religion by private persons in public, but also protects the public promotion of religion in public by public authorities. The Constitution does not demand a secular public sphere, as if it were leaving the religion free only in the private sphere, and that's because the federal Constitution was not intended to configure the public sphere in America. The public sphere in America existed before the Constitution did anything to it at all, and existed and continues to exist in the states and localities. And those states and localities are protected in their promotion of religion. Now, the second argument, which I will come back to at the very end, goes like this, that the Constitution's treatment of religion in this way is a good and a wise thing. In fact, as I will argue in a moment, we are now in a position to see better than ever why the Constitution's solution to these matters is a wise solution, and in a way that we never could see before. Now, as to the factual argument, one can begin, of course, from the text of the Constitution itself, and then secondarily refer to the history of its enactment. Regarding the text, many Americans, and maybe even some of you, may be in the habit of knowing and of thinking that the Constitution speaks to religion twice, which it does, and that speaks to it in the First Amendment, and it says in the First Amendment that there shouldn't be any religious establishment and that religious freedom should be protected, right? And then in Article 6, it says that religious tests for office are a bad thing. Now, that's the popular rendition of the Constitution in its two provisions most explicitly touching on religion. The text of the matter is different, of course, as no doubt you know. The First Amendment doesn't say that there shouldn't be any religious establishments. It says instead, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And in Article 6, it actually doesn't say that religious tests for office are a bad thing. It just says that they are not permitted with respect to federal office, any office under the United States. Now, what do these mean? They clearly don't mean on their surface what they seem to be, that they're alleged to mean by the popular mind. Certainly, the First Amendment prohibits Congress and not just anybody at all. It is clearly and explicitly a restriction on what Congress may do. And if we look back at the history of the founding moment, it is clear that the founding generation, which enacted the Constitution, which ratified it, was a generation very much accustomed to having governments involved in the public promotion of religion to varying degrees and in various ways. I find the most remarkably illuminating and persuasive book on this historical matter to be a recent edition published by the Library of Congress and authored by James Hudson, a chief of the manuscript division of the Library of Congress. I recommend this book to you highly. It's called Religion and the Founding of the American Republic. It's got lots of neat pictures in it. But among the things which James Hudson brings to our attention is the fact that Americans were pervasively accustomed to the metaphor of the nursing father to illustrate the role of the civil magistrate with respect to religion. That is to say, the civil magistrate's job was not to control religion, but to foster it. This metaphor animated many of the practices of the colonial and the early constitutional period. We've already heard from Reverend Hall an illustration of the Continental Congress's activity in promoting piety, and we note, of course, that the Continental Congress certainly did not refrain from being rather particularistic, to use a fancy word, in its promotion of piety, invoking, as we heard last night, the merits of our Lord Jesus Christ, who with God the Father and God the Holy Spirit lives and reigns forever and ever. If I'm not mistaken, there was such a reference in the Thanksgiving proclamation of the Continental Congress. This reflected the practice, which was even more profound and even more potent, shall we say, at the colonial, or rather the state level. The states, of course, used to do much more than even the Continental Congress did. Many state constitutions had in their preambles the explicit purpose announced on its face that the purpose of the state, or the Commonwealth as it may have been termed, was to promote the propagation of the Christian religion, or for the glory of God. And those state constitutions were full of provisions requiring educational institutions to promote religion, sometimes in even giving tax support for churches and ministers. But where that wasn't done, it was also the case that there were religious tests for office, for instance, in almost all of the colonies and then all of the states. In fact, it is observed now by those who know the history that the people who supported the ratification of the Constitution and who were enthusiastic about that provision in Article 6, which forbids religious tests for office, were the same people who were enthusiastic supporters of religious tests for office at the state level. Were they schizophrenic? No, they weren't schizophrenic. They recognized that any kind of federal test, religious test for office, might undermine religious tests for office where they really counted, namely in the states and localities. And thus, Article 6, far from being an implicit condemnation of religious tests for office, was understood by most people at the time as the guarantor of the persistence and stability of religious tests for office at the state level or below. Moreover, those state establishments of religion in their various forms persisted after the enactment of the Constitution, after the ratification of the Bill of Rights. Many of them lasted for a very long time indeed. Some stretched well into the 19th and even the 20th centuries in a way, for instance. You may not know this, but it is the case that the state of Maryland always had religious tests for office holding. In the beginning, back in the colonial era, of course, they specified affirmation of Christian faith in a fairly precise way. Later, it was amended to require that office holders in Maryland affirm their faith in God, simply, excluding, therefore, atheists, but not too many others. Now, it took the U.S. Supreme Court until 1961 to discover that Maryland had been violating the Constitution for 173 years since ratification, or perhaps for 273 years since they began having religious tests for office. In the case of Tarasco versus Watkins, the Supreme Court said no, this was violative of the Constitution for Maryland to have such a provision. My point here being that the Constitution was ratified and amended with the pervasive understanding that the states were entitled to have jurisdiction over the question of how far religion should be established, to what degrees, and in what ways. The Constitution, therefore, protected the states from Congress's intermeddling by enacting any laws respecting an establishment of religion. This point of view was clearly that of John Adams and others of the more well-known religious founders, but the point is made even more clear by referring to Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, when he was president, is, of course, on this subject most famous for his letter to the Danbury Baptists, in which he announced a wall of separation between church and state. And many, including the Supreme Court, which in its 1940 decisions began to enforce a different rule than the one specified in the Constitution, turned to Jefferson as an authority for their innovation. Jefferson, however, meant something rather different from what one might think. Thomas Jefferson, in his role as a state legislator in Virginia, sponsored and helped to enact fast proclamations almost identical to those of the Continental Congress. He thought there was nothing wrong with the state of Virginia, or himself acting as an agent thereof, to encourage traditional Christian piety. When he became president, however, Thomas Jefferson said that he shouldn't do what Washington and Adams had done, that is, he shouldn't proclaim official days of fasting and thanksgiving to God Almighty, because that would be to misunderstand the role of the national government. So to the Danbury Baptists, he explained his policy. Jefferson, of course, actually did, in many ways that fell short of official proclamations, did use all sorts of religious terminology, publicly thanking God for his many mercies to the nation. He simply would not enact official days of fasting and thanksgiving to God. It has been pointed out very decisively by Daniel Dreisbach that Thomas Jefferson's apparent change of mind was no change of mind at all. The reason that Jefferson would enact fast days at the state level when he was a state legislator and would not do so when he was the federal executive was because Jefferson understood there to be a profound difference in jurisdictions between the states and the national government on the question of religion. More precisely, one might say that for Thomas Jefferson, the wall of separation was between the church and the central national state, not between church and state more generally. In fact, if anything, there were two walls implicit in Jefferson's thought. On the one hand, a wall between the church and the national state, and on the other hand, a wall of separation between the states and the national government. And those two walls of separation account for what looks like, on the surface, a kind of schizophrenia. Now, this understanding that the First Amendment, understood especially to be amplified by the 10th, delineates areas of jurisdiction with respect to the question of establishment, was for a very, very long time the consensus view of ordinary Americans and of scholars and of jurists. Chief Justice John Marshall understood the First and 10th Amendments in this way. Justice Joseph Story wrote, for instance, very illuminatingly, he said that the purpose of the First Amendment was to exclude from the national government all power to act upon the subject of religion. The whole power over the subject of religion, said Story, is left exclusively to the state governments to be acted upon according to their own sense of justice and the state constitutions. Now, obviously, this feature of the Constitution has been set aside. The consensus has gone otherwise. We are now accustomed to the modern court's interpretation of the wall of separation between church and state as entailing a pervasive neutrality on the part of government at all levels, from the highest to the lowest, from the Congress to the lowliest local school board. This idea of neutrality between religion and irreligion has become the dominant principle. And this principle is even at work in those recent cases which are said by some to be favorable to religion. For instance, Lamb's Chapel versus Center Moriches Township in the early 1990s, or the case of Rosenberger versus University of Virginia, in which the Christian student newspaper had been deprived of funding and then got it back. Those cases themselves do not hinge upon any favorable attitude with regard to the public promotion of religion. They rather hinge upon the principle of neutralism. The reason those Christian students in Charlottesville got their money back was not because it was okay for Virginia to promote piety, but because it was wrong for Virginia to have any other posture than strict neutrality toward the questions of piety. The court turned this way because of a tide in of opinion. The court also turned this way as a technical matter because of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment prevents the states from taking away liberties from their own people. However, as has been pointed out not only by Daniel Dreisbach, but also by Akhil Reed Amar, the First Amendment's establishment provision is unincorporable. It's unincorporable because it is a delineation of jurisdiction, and one cannot incorporate against the states a delineation of jurisdiction which protects their jurisdiction. It is nonsensical, you might say. Of course, incorporation may be nonsensical, but that was no obstacle to the Supreme Court. All right, I'm running out of time, so let me finish by going quickly to my final point, which is that the original and existing constitutional rule, although forgotten and unenforced, is a good rule. I might summarize this with respect to two points. First of all, I heard Michael Novak recently say at a lecture in Washington that if men were angels, no governmental promotion of religion would be necessary. Point is clear. Secondly, we have discovered, by denying the Constitution's principle, its original merits. We have discovered now that, in fact, that the policy of comprehensive non-establishment, top-to-bottom religious neutralism, has perverse consequences, unanticipated probably by its early proponents. It turns out now that when the Supreme Court acts as a national school board, that far from having government neutrality toward religion, it turns out that religious neutralism or indifference turns out to be the formative public principle established in the hearts and minds of impressionable school children from their earliest days. It turns out, in fact, that the governmental neutrality toward religion is probably the most potent and difficult to resist form of religious establishment that we have ever seen. even proponents of religious neutralism now acknowledge that neutralism itself is a potent, substantive, and formative policy. I'm thinking of people like Amy Gutman of Princeton, Stephen Macedo, and others who argue that it is a good thing for the schools to promote moral and religious neutralism in students because our kids must not be raised to be bigots. California has launched on this new course quite clearly, using new forms of law regarding the schools to require the schools to promote among students new forms of piety, hitherto undreamt of, but now getting full backing of government. I propose to you that religious neutrality was merely a provisional policy. It was a kind of interregnum. It was an acid designed to eat away the old pieties until the new pieties should line up to receive state promotion in a way that the old pieties once did. All right, thanks so much.